Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, June 11th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or listening through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever discovered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the link in the upper left-hand corner that says Start Here, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book provides a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using for over 17 years now to great effect, to improve the quality of my life and relationships, and to effectively turn any negative emotional state I experience into part of the infallible guidance system that we've all been gifted with. You can also download the actual tool from that page on that website. It's a simple PDF file, print it off, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And by the time you're done typing Aramaic and beginning type the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will give you access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope you do that soon and often, and then give us a call. Or if you're listening in the archives, send us an email. You can email your questions to Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org. Or you can email me at tjh at mindshifters-academy.org. And we will do our best if we receive those emails to answer in an upcoming show, and then you can get access to the answer, our thoughts about your question in the archives. So another way to do it is to give us a call, 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1, and we'll have a conversation. Today, we're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons, and today is day 162 of this year. And today's lesson is, I am as the Creator created me. This single thought held firmly in the mind would save the world. From time to time today, we will repeat it as we reach another stage of learning. It will mean far more to you as you advance. These words are sacred, for they are words the Creator gave in answer to the world you made with your perception. By these words, the world you made with your perception disappears, and all things seen within its misty clouds and vaporous illusions will vanish as these words are spoken. For these words come from the Creator. I am as the Creator created me. Here is the word by which the offspring of creation became creation's happiness, his love, his completion. Here, creation is proclaimed and honored as it is. There is no dream that these words will not dispel. There is no thought of sin and no illusion which the dream contains that will not fade away before the might of these words. These words are the trumpet of awakening that sounds around the world. The dead awake in answer to this call, and those who live and hear this sound will never look on death. Holy indeed is he or she who makes these words their own, arising in them in his mind or her mind, recalling them throughout the day, and at night bringing them with her as she goes to sleep. The person who uses these words has dreams that are happy and rest that is secure. They have safety that is certain, and their body is healed because they sleep and awaken with the truth before them always. Today we practice simply, for the words we use are mighty and they need no thoughts beyond themselves to change the mind of she who uses them. So wholly is it changed, so completely is it changed, that it is now the treasury in which the Creator places all its gifts and all its love to be distributed to all the world, increased in the giving and complete because its sharing is unlimited. Thus you learn to think with the Creator. The Christ vision has restored your sight by salvaging your mind. We honor you today. Yours is the right to perfect holiness that you now accept. With this acceptance is salvation brought to everyone, for who could cherish sin when holiness like this has blessed the world? Who could have despair when perfect joy is theirs, available to all as a remedy for grief and misery? A remedy for all sense of loss and for all complete escape from sin and guilt. And who would not be brother to you now? You, the redeemer of your brother and sister. Who could fail to welcome you into his or her heart with loving invitation, eager to unite with one like herself in holiness? You are as the Creator created you. These words dispel the night and darkness is no more. Light is come today to bless the world, for you have recognized the offspring of creation, and in that recognition is the world's recognition. We're also doing the Course in Miracles experiment with Pam Grout, and in that book, Lesson 162 reads, her title is, Dear Depression, Kiss My Beautiful Truth-Proclaiming Ass. She quotes A Course in Miracles as saying, it gives its strength to everyone who asks in limitless supply. Pam writes, a person very close to me is struggling with depression. Since I used to believe that I too had depression, to borrow a Prince moniker, I refer to myself as joy previously masquerading as sorrow. So I wrote this person the following letter. Dear so-and-so, I've been thinking a lot about your depression because I've also suffered from the debilitating dis-ease. I feel that I can understand and perhaps help in some way. Here is what I know. The one thing wrong, in quotes, when I'm depressed is my thoughts. My thoughts start their incessant yammering. telling me I'm bad, that something is wrong with me, that life is hopeless. But what I now believe with complete certainty is that these thoughts are false. They are the tool of what I call the ego. The truth that I am as creation or the dude created me, Course in Miracles, Lesson 162. This truth is stronger than those erroneous thoughts. At any time, I can throw those thoughts overboard because they are powerless. They are as insignificant as a dandelion blowing in the wind. Luckily, I'm now able to laugh in the face of those thoughts. They are simply not true, and I refuse to buy into them. I am promised an abundant life, a life of joy, purpose, and peace. That's the only capital T truth. Thoughts of worthlessness are imposters. They get away with their bald-faced lies to the extent that I let myself believe them. They have no power except the power I give them. Quite frankly, I view them now as downright ridiculous. There is no way I can be worthless or bad or unloved. As for ego, it can kiss my beautiful, adorned by the source, butt. So that's Pam's thoughts on Lesson 162, I am as I was created to be. And that's the commentary from the Course in Miracles workbook lesson. And we have 48 minutes left to talk, to listen, to debate, to question. How can we support you? What's on your mind today? Today is a Friday, which means last night we had another support group. And we, what did we do last night? We watched, we got a preview of the Diedrich Wolsack interview that I did with him that will get published this next Tuesday on Mindshifters, on journeysdream.org/podcast. And we had one of our group members do a rather powerful worksheet. So all kinds of stuff is bubbling up for a lot of people. And we have 45 or 46 minutes left to help you entertain your comments or your questions, to raise a topic for discussion. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Dr. Tim. If it's okay, I have questions and follow-up stuff from yesterday with my grandson. I did some worksheets, and what I wanted from him was for him to wake up. Well, I feel as if I'm only just beginning to wake up, and the thought occurs to me that maybe I haven't waked up yet, so, and I'm still alive. My biggest fear in the worksheet is that he's not going to do well in life. He's going to be like his father, which it appears that in many ways he is, and that he's going to end up badly, and I want him to wake up. So it was quite a wake-up call to realize that I'm not waked up, and that spent my whole life in stages of unwakenedness and did very well anyway. And so I thought perhaps that may be true for him. Because, like today's lessons, he is as God created him. So I don't have to worry so much and can get more peaceful and be a more creative person. So I wrote a long journal letter to him, which I did not send, and it's a good thing. Today I felt clear enough to say, okay, Jacob Boone, we have to talk. Yesterday could have gone better. What do you say? He wrote back, said, yeah, I'm really sorry for everything, which is also part of the pattern. Have a blowout, apologize profusely, wait a while, have a blowout, apologize. So, you know, I'm taking all that in perspective, but he said, I'll call later. Yeah, I'd like to talk. So that's where we are. But I have a question. You raised the excellent point that Tim and I are supporting him in whatever he's doing, some of which is very negative. And we are tacitly supporting him by continuing with the allowance. But it also occurs to me that this is a boy who was punished so often by a rageaholic father that when he is not in his rage and not acting on stage or performing, where he is just amazingly powerful, he is the most frightened. The grandson.
Okay.
He is a very
frightened.
When he's
not in a rage, let me just clear it up. When he's not in a rage, and when he's not on stage performing in his true element of being a performance artist, then he is what?
Frightened of making a decision. This is just one example. I went with him when he was going to college for the first time. We did a grocery shop to set him up in his dorm. They had a little kitchen. Decide between two kinds of cereal, and stood really paralyzed because he couldn't decide which kind of cereal or which can of soup he should get. And I was amazed at how scared he seemed. And he said, yeah, I'm so afraid I'm going to make a mistake. So my thought is, and it may be wrong.
There's a Guy Finley talk. Wait, there's a Guy Finley talk.
Okay.
And in it, he brings out the mama. M-O-M-M-A.
Okay.
Or M-A-M-M-A, make as many mistakes as allowable, M-M-A-A.
Ah, nice.
And an infinite number are allowable.
Oh, that's great. I love it.
And so for anybody like that mm-hmm. believes that they are frozen in decision-making because they think they're frozen because they're afraid to make a mistake, it's really good to let them know this is a deep spiritual and psychological truth that people who do not make mistakes don't have success.
Great.
If you want to have success, you got to find a way to get comfortable making mistakes, what you call mistakes.
Yeah. Commenting too. So that's good. In light of his fearfulness, though, I'm afraid to punish him. I'm afraid taking away an allowance, even though he has a job. He has a job, but it doesn't cover his needs. And his needs include a medical marijuana card and medical marijuana for anxiety. He's not under the care of a doctor who is prescribing this, though. He is conscientious and careful and has figured out what he needs to be okay and does his best, as far as I know. He has told me this. I'm not sure he's telling the truth, but he's told me that he's taking only as much as he barely needs to take the edge off. But it's expensive, and so I thought, I want to talk to him. I want to tell him what I expect from him to be a responsible adult in the household and never, ever, ever go into the behavior that his father does and talk to him about the power person. I've done that before. I think he gets it already. But to tell him, we'll continue the allowance, but I want good reports from him or his mother. And I just am going to trust him that he'll do those things, but I'm not going to stop the allowance. To me, right now, that seems like my best thought. but I wanted to run it by you.
So if it goes wrong, you can blame me?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so...
As we were talking
about yesterday, this is a really complex set of issues, right? And there are people involved that I don't know anything about, and there are family dynamics. So you're doing the right thing to use your judgment. So let's just begin with that. This is a very complex thing, and oh, I was going to say this when you said that you want to tell him to never, ever exhibit the behaviors that his father did. Please don't say that.
Okay. See?
Why?
Good.
Why? Because you're giving him an impossible task, right? If Dr. Michael Rice were here, he'd give you the lecture about how if it's in you and it gets resonated, you don't have any choice about feeling it, right? And so the chances are he's going to get triggered and do the power person behaviors. So if you want to talk with him about that, good, give him the explanation, and then strongly encourage him to choose differently when he sees himself or somebody points out to him that he's doing those behaviors that are like his father. Because in the beginning, he really isn't going to have any ability to stop that, right? It's going to flare up. It's going to get triggered by the patterns in the family and you know, the intimate relationships he has with his mother and other people in the house and you and Tim. So to say to him, don't you ever, ever do this behavior, is just old stuff. That's part of the, you know, I'm trying to control things I don't have any control over. So more useful is to say, look, when this happens and you catch yourself, here's a set of tools you can use. And please, Diedrich Wolzak was saying this last night, there's a difference between being gentle with yourself and giving yourself permission to do harmful things. So we don't want you to make excuses about it. When these anger urges come up, when you get angry, when you rage, as soon as you can, catch it, take full responsibility for it, and use the tools.
Right.
Right? That's a better way to say it. It gives him something that he can work towards. But to say to somebody, you know, don't you ever do the behavior that your power person did, you're just setting yourself and them up for failure.
You just sounded exactly like my mother. I don't want you to ever do that again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you for mirroring my mom back to me.
There you go.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Tim.
And then whatever you do with the money, right, is... it's between you and Tim, and yeah. I would one other shift I would make in the way you were talking about it is that to withhold allowance from him is not a punishment, right? This is a gift you're giving him, and if you want to change it from a gift to a reward, then it's important to be clear about what are the behaviors expected to earn the reward.
That's a very interesting point.
And it's important not to mix the two up.
Right. Okay.
So, you know, to break it down and just make it really simple. In some families, there is no such thing as allowance. people are given food and clothes and shelter and education, and they're participating in recreational activities as the family funds allow, and it's just, it's a given part of, you know, participation in going to a movie or eating out at a restaurant or going to an amusement park is just given as part of membership in the family, right? And it happens no matter what. And in other families, they have, well, you know, we don't do allowance and we expect people to contribute, pull their fair share of chores around the house, making beds and cleaning rooms and mowing lawns and taking out garbage and things like that, doing dishes. And we give people an allowance based on their age and their needs so they can have some practice with how to use discretionary income.
Mm-hmm.
But we tell them, this is very limited. It's going to be this amount each week, and it's up to you to budget it if you want to, or blow it all right away at the beginning of the week and then have nothing left. But there won't be any advances on future allowances and stuff like that, because this is an exercise in you learning to establish your relationship with money. And that allowance in some of those situations is given, and it's independent of the person's behavior. And in other cases, the allowance is tied directly to certain chores that are done. And when you do this chore, you get 25 cents. And when you do this chore, you get another 25 cents. And when you mow the lawn, you get $5, et cetera. But the chore has to be done to the level of expectation of the parent who is supervising that chore. And if it isn't done to their expectation, you don't get the full amount or you don't get anything until it's done to their expectation. So I would caution you against mixing those things up, right? Either give it to him and he's getting it no matter what just because he's part of the family, which might mean, you know, you're giving him a subsistence level, like you give him food and clothes and shelter and education. And if in some families that allowance is part of that, and it's very modest, or you give it to him because he's earned it by doing certain very specific things, and you don't give it to him when he hasn't done those things.
Yeah, well, that's going to be complicated if we do that arrangement, because it would mean relying on reports from him and his mother. And he really resents it if there is triangulation going on. And there is.
Okay. That's his generating resentment, right? That's not you causing resentment in him. Let's just be clear about that. We talked about that yesterday, too. And there are simple ways around that, right? If you're saying, you know, this is too complicated, okay, then give the money to his mother and let her decide what he gets and doesn't get.
Yeah.
Right? If she would like to be able to do that, but she doesn't have the income and you want to support her, then support her by giving her the money. And she stays the authority in the house. And she stays the gatekeeper for whether or not he has earned and therefore receives these various levels of financial reward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? If the real thing is we want to get grandma and grandpa out of the picture so it's not so complicated, there are ways to do that. One way is to just stop giving the money altogether and let him figure out a way to make what he needs now that he's 21. Another way is to give the money to the head adult in the family and let her disperse it as she sees fit.
Yeah. I'll ask her about that. Their relationship is so complicated, though, that this might add another stress between them. You know, I'm going to have to think about that, but those are all good ideas.
Well, you're on it, and that's what you need to do. You need to think about it, and you need to take into account what you know about the players and their personalities and their history, and then just, you know, ask to be shown what's the best thing to do and follow through with it and trust it's all going to work out, which includes doing your own work and maybe redoubling some efforts to do the Pierre Pradervan Gentle Art of Blessing so that you don't spend any more time than is absolutely necessary thinking, oh, my gosh, he's going to turn out just like his dad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when you catch that, and when you catch that, call a timeout for yourself and shift instead to the Pierre Pradervan Gentle Art of Blessing, seeing him in his perfect wholeness, seeing him taking advantage of all the wonderful things he's seen modeled by you and Tim and his mother. Yeah, he does have the input from his father who had some serious wounds, but that does not determine who he is and what his life becomes. And there is no, and there's no reason that you have to spend more than a moment past the recognition that that's what's happened in your own thought, entertaining those thoughts. As soon as you recognize, all you need, as soon as you recognize that that thought has arisen, you recognize it and you choose again. There's Diedrich Woolsack's work, Choose Again. Course in Miracles tells us over and over again, choose again.
Is that what it means in the worksheet when it says, I release my story? I release my thoughts? The story should be like the responsibility communication thing. Only what could be videotaped or audiotaped, the story. What actually happened, right? That's the story. And then you have your thoughts about
the story. Well, it depends on the context that you're using. Sometimes people use the story to mean what actually happened. And sometimes they use it to mean my excuses. And in the worksheet process itself, where it says, I cancel my need to be right, I cancel my need to make up another story out of these brain cells to hallucinate the proof that my fear and hostility-based story, my reality, is true. Now we're using it in a different context, completely different meaning.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay.
And that's why Dr. Rice has found it so useful to make a distinction between actuality and reality. So we get out of the whole thing about using the word story.
Yeah.
My reality is a story that my mind is making up, and it's full of actual perceptual images in my brain, but it doesn't make it the capital T truth. So my reality is my story about life and what it means. The actuality doesn't change from person to person. The reality does. The story does. So in that way, you can use the word story interchangeably with reality, meaning the perceptual reality that an individual creates.
Right. That's good.
So I would, you know, I would encourage you to pour some more of your own mind energy into that part of your mind that can be vigilant. And at the earliest warning sign that you are creating a thought or operating from the belief that, oh my gosh, my grandson's going to turn out exactly like his father and his life's going to be a mess, that you catch that thought. Recognize the negative emotional state that arises in you when it happens and understand that that's proof positive that this is a false belief. Right?
Yeah.
I know my thoughts are in error. when my emotional response is negative. And then the next best thing to do is jump into the Pierre Pratervand Gentle Art of Blessing process. Hold the image of him in his complete innocence and vulnerability and invulnerability, perfect safety is what I meant to say there, and his ability to choose and to use all of the good stuff that he's had modeled for him from you and Tim and his mother and any other good mentors in his life, and see him thriving.
God, that's so good. And that is, I have the Pratervand book in, I mean, using it right now, but this reminds me of a lesson we had a few days ago, or maybe it was only yesterday. Somewhere in the lesson, it said that Christ dreamed the dream of a forgiven world. Let us for an instant dream with him. And I think that's what Pratervand is doing. He's seeing a forgiven or an innocent person. He's choosing to see that at every
yes.
turn. And it
yes.
says only for an instant. I thought that was amazing that it said, let us for an instant dream with him. As if that would be all that's necessary or something.
Well, it certainly,
anyway.
It certainly for some of us, would be a challenge to even let it happen for an instant. But once we do, we open Pandora's box and you know, we start the avalanche going downhill. It's going to build its momentum.
Mm-hmm.
If even for an instant you could perceive the truth of your life and the people around you, it would change your life forever.
Ah, yeah. You know, I was listening to the rest of the Pliner thing. What a blabber BG was. Man, he was so fluent. You hardly got a word in edgewise, and it didn't matter because he got it all across. But I thought, how exhausting. I wonder if he's like that as a therapist. It would be hard to work with him. But I was thinking, I was thinking how much I would like to have this grandson listen to that if he could get all the way through it, or he wouldn't even need to. The points are made fairly early on, and you know, but I'm in danger of getting into fix-it mode, really. And so anyway, this is one thought I had that I'd like to hand this podcast over to my grandson, but maybe that's too much. He's terrible at what he eats, though. He's really hurting himself the way he eats. So anyway.
Well, I would just encourage you to do a quick breath and check in and ask to be shown what the right thing is to do, and then if you choose to share it with him, it'll be fine, and if you choose not to, it'll be fine. You know, there's no harm in sharing. There is plenty of harm we can do to ourselves with our negative thoughts at the egoic level, and there's nothing that we can do to harm our true self no matter what. So rest in that. And understand that your desire, your intention to help is always there. And then just trust that it's going to work out no matter what, even if it's not going to work out the way your conscious logical mind is telling you it should.
You know, that's the best part of the worksheet is that pattern that says, I give up any goal. I give up even a goal to have a successful worksheet. I give up the goal of giving up the goal. I mean, or whatever you said. I don't have it in front of me. But it's a total canceling of everything. So you're just left with nothing. And it's a wonderful nothing.
That's the idea. I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need for anyone or anything to change, including myself. I cancel the specific goal in this worksheet. I put my conscious logical mind on the shelf for now, and I ask to be shown the hidden part of my own mind that's actually creating this upset. And then I just watch, and I trust that any thoughts, any images, any physical sensations that come to mind, they're going to be part of what I need to see to begin to heal here and move forward.
Yeah.
And I just keep repeating that I cancel my need to be right. Cancel my need for anyone or anything to change, including myself, and watch the magic happen when the ego gets out of the way. So, thoughts, comments, questions, answers?
I'm just thinking about what you said, and it's going to be very helpful to have talked to you today. I think I have some things I could say to Jake. That's good. Thanks.
You're entirely welcome and deserving. Thank you for the call.
Okay.
So I'll mute you, and you can raise your hand again if you feel the need, and we'll open it up for somebody else.
Okay.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What are your thoughts, comments, questions, answers about anything we've talked about in the last 10 years or the conversation we're having with Susan about her fears about how her grandson's life is going to turn out? Questions and comments about the worksheet. We had somebody in the group last night who did a very powerful worksheet, and we have time to either frame out some worksheets or do a quick worksheet with someone if you have any interest in that. And I think I mentioned that Diedrich Wolsack interview will be posting next Tuesday, if all goes well, in the On Your Mind podcast. You can get it at journeysdream.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. And even though it's pretty much an hour long or close to an hour long, the unedited version that we shared in the group last night, people said that kind of went by in a flash. So lots of good stuff. Very, very similar tool derived from the Course in Miracles, and the idea that forgiveness is about an internal process. It's never about somebody or something outside of me. And that, as I was mentioning in the interview, it's a delightful thing to get the same fundamental process discussed from a slightly different perspective. And the slightly different perspective is that Deidre talks about, what are my core beliefs? Because my core beliefs, as long as they're there and they're in effect within me, they're going to drive the selection of the emotions and therefore the behaviors that I exhibit. And so when I don't like the emotions I'm experiencing or the behavior patterns that I'm involved in, far more useful than any behavior modification program or any other talk therapy psychology is to find a tool, and he provides a tool for this, but find a way to get access to my core belief that's driving that unpleasant or unsatisfactory behavior, and just work to dismantle the core negative and therefore false belief, and then there'll be no need for the behavior modification. Because when people are acting from the awareness of their true nature as love, they don't do self-destructive things. They don't do hurtful or abusive things in relationships. They don't ingest poisonous substances. They don't do behaviors to run away from or numb themselves to internal emotional pain because they're not experiencing the pain when they're tapped into their true nature. So there are a number of people who are tapping into the same deeply healing process, slightly different versions, and we're grateful to be able to bring you yet another one this next Tuesday on the On Your Mind podcast. So we have 14 minutes left, or 13 or 12, something like that, 563-999-3581. Call that number, press 1, and we can have a conversation. Or you can suggest a topic. Or you can suggest a guest for us to interview or a book to read. I am working my way through the Gabor Mate book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And I can recommend that for you if you have a strong stomach, because here's a man who went to some of the worst, most difficult to deal with human beings in his city and made it his job to help make their lives a little bit more tolerable and to be in the space of accepting them as valuable human beings, even though they are caught in the pattern of self-abuse that is addiction. And so some of the stories are going to be difficult to hear. Yet some of the learnings that he has acquired are extraordinarily useful. And the harm reduction model that he's developed, that many places have adopted, is helping improve the life quality for people and helping people understand that it's more beneficial to treat other human beings with respect than it is to try and punish them for whatever behaviors they're doing, most of which are coming as a fairly direct result of the abuse they sustained early in life. And rather than sit in an ivory tower and judge these people as bad or wrong, he highlights his efforts and his learning from being with these people and fighting the urge to judge them negatively and as less than, and letting them be his teachers, as he studies, the pain, instead of asking why the abuse, why this substance or that substance, he says, ask why the pain. What's the source of the pain? And when we go to the source, as Dr. Michael Rice talks about so often in his lectures, we're working at a cause level, then the changes we make are infinitely more productive. And if we stay out at the level of chasing symptoms, we're severely limiting our ability to have a positive impact. So what's your comment? What's your question? What's on your mind? 10 minutes left. I think one of my favorite things about the process of getting suggestions from people is how much I learn and I expand my horizons. So we have people like Corinne Zupko, who picked up A Course in Miracles and turned it into a productive set of tools for helping herself go from debilitating anxiety to a sense of love and purpose in her life. And I only found out about that book because Susan Bingham said, hey, look at this book. That led me to several others. Now somebody else listens to the show and says, hey, Dr. Tim, you sound a lot like that Diedrich guy. So I look up Diedrich, and the next thing you know, I have another tool, another slight variation on the same tool to add to my toolkit. So who do you know? What podcasts do you listen to? What books have you read recently that you think are a positive impact on your life that you want to share with us, or that you'd like to have me read and or do an interview with the author? Again, if you're listening to this on the archives, you can email those suggestions to me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email questions and comments to Jeannie at jeannie@yagain.org. I was on autopilot there. I had somebody in my office earlier today, and we were talking about the trap, the real detrimental trap of putting people up on a pedestal, and how often we're conditioned and trained to do that in our society. I mean, think of the millions of dollars that we pay athletes, and we pay actors and actresses and musicians. Just a select few in each category. And sometimes, you know, the millions of dollars we're paying one team or one athlete is determined by fractions of a second or a minute or two or a few points on a scoreboard. So the trap, the detrimental impact of putting people up on a pedestal was the topic of their conversation in a session earlier today. And one of the things that really solid research teaches us is that the lower someone's actual intelligence, the greater probability they're going to think they know more, the greater the probability they're going to overestimate their intelligence. And the more intelligent somebody is, the more likely they are to underestimate. So when you're putting somebody else up on a pedestal, in some way, aside from distorting the truth and distorting your perception, you're blocking yourself from seeing how we're all the same. And depending upon your own internal dynamics, you may be using putting somebody up on a pedestal and thinking of them as being so much better at this, that, or the other thing than you are, or having more worth as a person than you do. You might be using that to live into a false belief you have about yourself of not being worthy or not being smart enough or good enough. And as Diedrich Wolzak points out, once I hold a negative core belief, I will look for the evidence. This is exactly like Dr. Michael Rice's work. The mind is an evidential device, and if I ask it to show me how you're the cause of the pain in my life, it will show me that evidence. Well, Diedrich Wolzak takes it another step and says, when I hold the belief that I'm a hateful person, I will end up doing behaviors that show me in my interaction with others how hateful I am, how bad I am, how wrong I am. Whether it's that I have guilt around my sexuality from some childhood or adolescent interactions, and then I grow up and I actually keep acting out in unproductive or unhealthy ways sexually, I'm going to keep providing for myself the evidence that proves this negative core belief. And the only way out of that pattern, well, the only reasonable way, according to Diedrich, is not the behavior modification. It's not locking the person up. It's not the punishment. It's to undo, to identify and then see through the false nature of the negative core belief. And once that happens, the cascading relief and change in behavior and mood and access to higher resources is amazing. But if we don't work to identify and then dismantle the false negative beliefs we have about ourselves, then we can do behavior modification until the cows come home, and it's just going to be putting a Band-Aid on a raging infection. The other thing that I've mentioned is that Diedrich talks about this, the rainforest effect, and he says, you know, he's got this retreat center in Costa Rica at about 2,500 feet overlooking a lake, and it's rainforest, surrounded by rainforest. And he says it's just, it's so alive, you can hardly believe it. It's so beautiful, you can hardly believe it. And yet, it's a rainforest. So he said you can make a path in a rainforest, but to do that, you need strong arms and a really sharp machete. And you've got to work and work and work. And he says if you're out there for 2 or 3 days, you can eventually make a path in the rainforest. But if you decide, I'm tired, I need a break, I want to go on vacation for a week or two, when you come back, you probably won't find the path because the rainforest has overgrown it. And he says, that's like the life conditioning and these negative memories and all the years we've spent, negative beliefs, that we've spent living from those negative beliefs. We have neural pathways that are like a 12-lane highway that actually were constructed around these negative beliefs about self, these core negative beliefs. And he says, if you have tools like the Reality Management Worksheet, the Mindshifter Targeted Journaling Tool, or Diedrich Wolsack's 6-Step Choose Again Forgiveness Process, if you have effective tools like this, you can carve a path. If you don't keep at it day after day, the path will disappear. If you do keep at it day after day, you can eventually carve a 12-lane highway through the rainforest, through the neural pathways in your mind. You can work to the point where you've dismantled a significant proportion or percentage of those negative core beliefs, and they are no longer there to drive your behavior and your negative emotions. So we encourage people to do that soon and often, and then give us a call. We're down to about a minute and a half, so I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tian. And I was just looking that guy up. So that was the 6 Steps to Freedom book that you were talking about?
No. This is choose-again.com.
Oh, okay.
And when you go there, he has a 6-step forgiveness process, choose again forgiveness process that's available absolutely free. And it is the choose again 6 steps to freedom that's at the top of the website.
Okay.
But
awesome.
But there's
a
simple HTML that you can download, just like you and Michael let people download the Reality Management Worksheet.
Great. Very good.
All right. Have a lovely show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Friday, June the 11th, 2021, and our call-in number is 563-999-3581, and press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And we're getting ever so much closer to getting the apps up. I was on there with India for quite a while yesterday, and we've got one little glitch with Google. I haven't checked this morning. Today's been a little bit crazy. I had a doctor's appointment and then had to go to the grocery store and then get back and fix Dad breakfast. And so I haven't had a chance to get online, but I think the Apple may be up and running. I hope it is. I'll check that after the radio show. But we're having a little bit of issue with Google, and so hopefully that'll be squared away by the end of the day. And by Monday, both of them should be working, I hope. So it's exciting. Got some new features, and it seems to be working better. And what they do is once we work out all the issues, and usually we get online, and so the guy in India is online and I'm online. We're kind of, it's not by Zoom, but it's by Skype. And he'll make a change and he'll show it to me on the computer, and I'll let him know whether I need him to do it differently or not. And so I think that the technicians have gone through the forgiveness app so many times, they probably kind of have the gist of what this is about now. So, but I've got a really good guy that I'm working with, and he's got a real good handle, fluent in English. And so it's been a pleasure working with him. But hopefully both of those apps will be up and running by Monday, and then I hope to get the one on the website cleared up as well. So let us know if you run into anything, and I think I've gotten all the broken links fixed on the Why Again site. Go out there and play around and look at the different things, and drop me an email at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org. Let me know if you run into something or if something's missing that you can't find. It may be in a little bit different place, but I think everything is still out there. It just may be titled a little different or linked a little different. So let me know if you run into anything. Welcome, Michael.
And Jeannie, you know, your effort has been Herculean, and I don't know if it's appropriate to give you as a woman the title of Hercules, but what you've done with, I mean, 3,000
words. Pull your microphone up a little. You're a little muffled.
Okay. All right. So, you know, 3,000 links and two apps in the website app, and transferring the whole website over, it's just huge, so. Thank you for all the dedicated, and I really mean dedicated work you've done with it. It's awesome. And hopefully it will more functional and easier for people. And I love the fact that we now have the commitment in there, and I'm thinking about what we can put in next.
Slow down.
A week or two before we do any of that. But anyway, it's pretty awesome. It's pretty awesome. I mean, the fact that we have this app now with what, 5 different versions of the commitment in it now that people can go to right through the app on their phones. I mean, it's just pretty amazing. I just had the thought that maybe we should ask him what we need to do to put a share button in so that any part of it that somebody wants to share with you, they can just click a share and send it off the commitment or the worksheet. Just a thought.
Well, the way it is right now, when you go to something, and if it's like the commitments, if I open up one of the commitments, you open it up on in your PDF, whatever kind of PDF reader you use, and so
right.
That's on your screen, and then you can use the phone's regular
share
menu
button
to send the file or open it with something else or to print it or to download it. So that option is already there, so you can share that with someone else.
Cool. Pretty amazing. The technology, I mean, that the technology has fallen in place. One, for us to be able to do this radio show 5 days a week for 10 years to carry this conversation forward and put out that support. And then the fact that we have this app now and anybody in the world can access it and have the instruction. It's just... It's mind-boggling, and it's awesome that this morning, as I was kind of coming back to outer meditation time, it was just like such deep appreciation for everything that we have that we can take this work forward and make it available. It's pretty amazing. So thank you for your technology brain and your technology skills, I couldn't even start to touch what you're doing with that. So it is deeply, deeply appreciated, as you are.
Thank you.
You are most welcome. And as Dr. Tim would say, so deserving. So let's take a look at the next chapter in Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Chapter 14. For those who are following along with us, it's page 79 on Choosing Teachers. If you want to get a copy of the book to follow along with us, we can't sell you one because it's out of print. We don't have any. However, if you go on to Amazon or you go on to eBay, you know, way back in 1995 when we published it, I don't even remember how many tens of thousands of copies were spread around the globe. And so there are always lots of them, dozens and dozens on Amazon and in eBay that you can pick up pretty recently used. And so it's out there, and you can also go to our website and click on the book, and it'll take you to links to download the book free in English, German, Spanish, Thai. I'm working on getting back the Swedish publication, Russian, Danish. The others that I'm missing. Anyway, all those different languages are there free to download the book. You're certainly welcome to read along with us. And if you're not familiar with the book, it's a conversation between myself and a character named Richard, who's not a real person, but is a composite of several real people with real responses and real interactions that I've had with people around this whole idea of shifting the mind out of its hostility and fear-based perceptions, learning to remove the root of fear-based perception and restore the mind to its proper connection and power supply, which is love. So, you know, not exactly the kind of conversation that this culture, as it's going these days, in the public forum, generally have. People
you just kind of muted, you know, again, Michael. I don't know if your microphone is not hooked in good.
I don't know. I'll try it again. Is that better?
Yeah, just keep it up,
okay.
I guess, close to your mouth.
Okay. So it's interesting how people just seem to love their hostility and fear-based relationships, their political opinions, their, you know, in the public square, there's some pretty crazy stuff going on. And fortunately, we're seeing more and more every day of people who are sane and really working to bring change about in war zones and in starvation. I mean, if you look at where this world was 50 years ago in terms of the number of people starving, we have made monumental strides. And thank you to everybody who's stepped up and done something about that, because there are tens of thousands of people who are doing things like that every day, and I certainly want to acknowledge them. But if you're listening and you've come to really enjoy or hate but enjoy your hostility and fear-based mind, if you've got one, we're here to say that it's possible. Now, it's not going to happen instantly. It's going to take time, but it's possible to live in a mind, in a body, without hostility or fear. And all you need to do is remove it. And the removal tool in the first century Aramaic language was called forgiveness. So please take the tools, put them to work. You don't need to believe anything. And you hear us referring to the ancient Aramaic scriptures, the New Testament, the Old Testament. But please, if you would, remove all of the religious projections that you have on those texts and recognize that they are physics and physiology, psychology and genetics, period. They're not theology. That's man's twist that has allowed men to make war with other men for centuries. What we're here to do is to restore, what did this stuff actually mean? And somebody who's invested, you know, their power, their paycheck, their, you know, hold over people comes from total and complete misinterpretations and mistranslations of the words of this man, Yeshua. You know, they don't particularly want to hear what the man said. And my focus is, first order of business is, let's go to the first century Aramaic meanings of words and see what those words mean. And when you do, you find that he often said the exact opposite of what many are teaching as dogma and doctrine. In fact, you never heard him talk about, my dogma is this. He speaks of a purpose that he has. And his purpose, he puts in one single, simple sentence. I come to bring you life, to bring you life more abundantly. That's all. What do you suppose an abundant life looks like? Well, I'd offer that if you're living one in hostility and fear and rage and poverty and drama, that to have a life where physiologically you're at peace, mentally you're in serenity, pretty abundant life, relatively speaking. And I'd offer that if you go back to the first century Aramaic teachings, and belief is not a part of the equation. You don't have to believe anything. That's the domain of the dogma and the doctrine, folks. I don't have any dogma. I don't have any doctrine. I got some tools. Don't believe in the tools. Just pick one up and use it. You know, if you got a shovel, you don't have to believe in a shovel to say, I have a hole over there. Somebody told me if I go put my hands on the shovel and I put my foot on it, that I can push in and pull up the dirt. Now, I don't have to believe that. I can take the shovel and go over, put my hands on it, put my foot on it, push in the dirt and see if it works. If it works, you know, like, what is there to believe? It works. That's all. If you will take the tools, especially the tool of forgiveness, which has nothing to do with, I'm going to let you off the hook because there's pain or drama and trauma happening to me. If you take that tool from the first century Aramaic language and you put it to work in your life, it's kind of like a shovel. You know, put your foot on the edge of the shovel and you push it into your own mind, into your own drama, into your own trauma, and you begin the removal process. Now, I say begin. You know, if I've got a pretty big hole to dig, I'm not going to get it done with one shovel full of dirt. If I have a history, you know, if I can't think of anybody, and this is so common, I've asked the question of thousands of people, if I can't think of anybody that I know that lives in a serene, peaceful, healthy, happy way with joy and aliveness and abundance around them, chances are I don't either. And if I don't, it's because I don't know how to produce that result. I've learned how to produce a result. You know, probably one of the greatest atrocities done to us as human beings down through the ages and that we have bought into is that we've had hidden from us the fact that we are by nature creators. And when I realize that I'm the one creating my drama and trauma, now my mind's going to show me that somebody else delivered it to me, but they couldn't move that energy in me unless that energy was in me. And if I don't like it, I need to dig out the shovel and get it out. Just remove it. So as opposed to dogma and doctrine, we've got tools. And here they are. And, you know, one of the things that I've been realizing recently, and I see this as a really key idea, is that the experiences of pain, of hatred, of vengeance, of rage, of grief, we have those experiences because they are wired into our perceptual systems. If they weren't in the perceptual system, we wouldn't be experiencing them. You know, you've heard me say many times, gee, if I've been through this painful reality 87 different times with 42 different people, and I'm the only one that was there, maybe I'm involved in my life. And I'm realizing, actually I shared this with Jeannie yesterday, you know, that we've talked, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times over this 10 years about the fact that forgiveness collapses perception. I'm realizing, and it just struck me yesterday, each of the tools collapses perception. where those things are wired in. And when perception collapses, we get a chance to take another look. We get a chance to comprehend something other than this ongoing nagging mind of the generations of the world that keep us in hostility and fear. And we think the hostility and fear is real and the fault of somebody or something out there. The truth is, the only reason you have ever experienced it is because it's wired into your nervous system and into your perceptual system. And when you find a tool, you will never find a more valuable thing in all the world than a tool that will collapse your pain's perception and give you the opportunity to have a different experience from being. So the forgiveness worksheet process directly does that. But then you'll notice if you go into still point breathing, the pain perception all of a sudden starts to melt and disappear. You know, we've been talking with Magda about the responsibility communication process. Notice, Magda, and those who are listening, those who were part of the intensive last week, we did that. Notice that when you start to speak words of truth and responsibility, perception collapses based in the hostility and fear. And you get to address what's really at the root of the mind. You get to discover what's there. And if it doesn't serve you, you get to dissolve it. It's the same thing. It's the collapsing of perception. You have an aha moment. What's happened when you have an aha moment? Well, a moment ago, I thought things were this way, and now I'm going, oh, my God, it's this way. Wow, aha. What just happened? My whole perception collapsed. If you utilize the codependence tool, you'll find that when you begin to apply the advice you have for others to your own life, the old blame in the mind will collapse, and you'll discover that with that collapse, you have access to parts of your mind, direct access, rather than filtering it through your brain's image of someone else. You have direct access to that part of your mind. And when it comes forward in the presence of being, healing happens. And I'll just say that it was just yesterday that it occurred to me that's the common link. I mean, I've spent 50 years developing these tools. And the common link with each of them is that when you use it, that part of your mind where pain is wired in collapses. If you're carrying around drama and trauma and pain, I'd offer that is the absolute most valuable tool you will ever have. And we're here to give those tools to you. We're here to be in a conversation about those tools. We're here to bring them to the forefront and support the Excuse me, I'm back. I'm back on. Excuse me, I had accidentally in moving my microphone touched the disconnect button. My bad. Well, we're going to go to page 79, and why is this happening to me again, choosing teachers. And I start this chapter up talking to Richard, saying, there are so many people, Richard, who've rejected one of the most vital parts of their lives, their spirituality. My observation is that those who do this are usually people who've listened to someone with no practical spiritual savvy. Years of study and intellectual knowledge about doctrine and religion do not necessarily translate into an actual spiritual experience. And, you know, when you think about it, who can instruct you to have an experience that they haven't had? Nobody. And so you watch people. A particular situation comes to mind. I was in a church in Springfield, Missouri. Oh, this is probably 15 years ago now. I'd been invited by someone and went to their church. And the preacher is up there in the front, and he's talking about love, and he's about love, and boy, it's all about love. And Jesus and love, and Jesus and love, and love and Jesus. And they had a sanctuary set up where his family sat in some benches off to the side of where he was standing speaking. And his three-year-old child came up to him. Like, you know, the three-year-old doesn't know from church and what are these people doing here and what's my daddy doing. The three-year-old goes up with his arms out like, you know, hey, daddy, I want a hug. I want some of your attention. And this guy who's telling all the BS he's got about love turns with such a vicious look at this child and a vicious voice and a look at his wife like, why aren't you controlling this little, I won't even use the words that were conveyed. It's like, words, words, words. But if we can't translate the words into action, so what? What does it mean? So it sounds good, but are we actually doing it? And again, without tools, I mean, everybody, of course, has wonderful ideas and wants to be with those wonderful ideas. But if you can't incarnate those ideas, what good is it to you? You know, there's a thought in the scriptures where Yeshua says, yeah, you swallow, you strain a gnat and you swallow a camel. Ah, you got somebody up there that does this terrible thing. And this terrible thing is nothing. But you finance war and murder without a second thought. Swallow a camel and strain a gnat. That really mean? It's time for us to wake up to what this game of life is really about. And if it's really about living as a human being at every moment and allowing your physiology to soften and open so that your human beingness gets to filter in, gets to incarnate in every cell of your structure. But if we're run by a dogma or a doctrine that's in the head only, and there are no tools for incarnating it, then we see things like this hypocrisy. You know, we've been talking to Richard the last couple of chapters, and he brought up the offense in him around hypocrisy that he saw in his church, in his early upbringing. You know, parents who would be high and holy rollers at church and go home and, you know, be quite willing to dish out a slap in the head or what have you, or a degrading comment to a child. That's straining a gnat and swallowing a camel. And because the actual tools that were taught by Yeshua really aren't understood very well or often applied, it makes for a great philosophical discourse, but can you live it? What we're interested in doing with these tools is bringing it forward in a way that each and every one of us can live it and have access to how to incarnate it. Translations of the Aramaic teachings are so distorted today, I said. I often wonder if it's been done purposely. I felt some of my own upset at that thought. The translations appear sound, but are twisted just enough to cover up the wisdom that was available through the original words. And so a significant amount of effort by the translators who worked with the Kabor's manuscript that we're working from. I mean, a significant amount of effort was put into making sure that they understand and translated words according to the meanings in context of this man's words 2,000 years ago, rather than substituting Greek philosophy for what he said. You've probably heard me say this before. It's kind of one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines. So if Yeshua sat in most churches today, he'd say, that's all Greek to me. All this raving and raging and hellfire and sin and damnation and, excuse me, you really believe that that's what love is about? You really believe that a creator called love is about all of that? Excuse me, you're listening to men who are about all of that, or men and women who are about all of that. It's not the creator that's about that. And so this man, yes, it wasn't any different 2,000 years ago than it is today. There's lots of hypocrisy. And what you find Yeshua doing is instructing the elders of the church. That's what got him killed. He threatened their little power and bailiwick. And so they arranged to have him murdered. And then they created an interesting little piece of so-called theology where they said, and the reason he was put to death was because of your sins. Excuse me, folks. That's such a pile of bunk that if you try to digest it, it's insane. The man was murdered because he threatened the power structure of the day. The other is a black ops, the equivalent of a military black ops cover story that convinces the public of a lie. It was one reason and one reason only. He threatened the money, the power, and the control of the controllers of today. And he offered them support for their healing process as well. Because that's what actual human life does. It offers support, whether somebody is a friend or an enemy. Doesn't matter. And so in the coming days, we'll be looking more at this idea of discerning which kind of teacher you want to pick. Now, in essence, our bottom line that we'll reach by the end of this chapter is that if the benefits of what you're being taught are accruing to the teacher, you're in front of a false teacher. If the benefits are accruing to you, then you're in front of a true teacher. That's a simple bottom line of it. And so we appreciate the fact that you're here with us, listening to this conversation. If it's meaningful to you, if you've got someone in your life that you think it might be meaningful to as well, when the show is over, you can go to our website, whyagain.org. And when you get to that site, there's a microphone on the homepage. Scroll down a little bit. There's a microphone. Click the microphone. And then just go through the links, drill down until you're at today's date. And when you're at today's date, there'll be a link to either listen to or download this particular conversation. So if you've got somebody in your life that you think might be ready for any given conversation, and we've got, I don't even know how many now, probably somewhere around, Jeannie, 3,500 or so hours of radio shows from the last 10 years, 5 days a week for 10 years. And each one is a conversation about some aspect of integrating into your physiology, into your mind, into your emotions, into your thinking processes, the fuel that those things are designed to run on. And that fuel is love. And freeing from the structure anything based in any form of hostility or fear. So that no matter what happens, the automatic decision system in the mind kicks into some piece of information or some piece of advice from your mind that's based in love. And And so, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
We do have a hand up, and it is Miss Susan, area code 610. You're on the air.
Hey, welcome,
hey guys.
Lady.
Hi. Michael,
hey.
You're talking about the Aramaic, and I have been meaning to ask you this question. Psalm 130. Now, let me go get it. I'm going to run. Just there's a part of it that has a word in it, a phrase in it that I do not understand. It's the use of the word feared. Yes, he says, Lord, if thou, Lord, shouldest mark iniquities, who shall stand? But there is forgiveness with thee that thou mayest be feared. Can you do anything with that?
Yes, I sure can. I sure can. You know, it's interesting that, you know, of the 32,000 sects of Christianity that are in existence in the world today, you know, 32,000 different people who started a teaching that supposedly was about Yeshua, and of course, everyone in the world proclaimed they have the only true teaching. Well, I don't have the true teaching of Yeshua. I've got some of his tools, and they work pretty well, but you'll arrive at your own teaching when you do that. But, you know, it's interesting that one of the most common phrases, and every time I've ever confronted a preacher with this one, they say, well, that's what I meant, really. And that is the phrase that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And it's like, excuse me? So you represent a man who, in at least, if I remember correctly, 15 different times said, fear not, 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 fear not. And now you're standing there telling me that fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. It's like, hello, is anybody home? And then they say, oh, well, we really mean honor and respect. It's like, well, then why don't you say the beginning of wisdom is honor and respect for the Creator? And so my offering there is, that's one of those lines that Yeshua would say, that's all Greek to me. So he's saying that, you know, here is this empowered presence of active love called the Creator. And if you are open to and connected with that powerful presence of love, anything that you hold in you that would destroy you, any form of rage or guilt or grief or pain that you're willing to open will dissolve, which is what forgiveness is, will dissolve from your physiology, from your mind, from your emotions. And it will be gone from you. So that's what I hear them saying in that particular passage. And then what will happen is your mind will automatically step into respect and honoring. Wow, what a gift. I mean, how cool is that? Here I am. I've made up, or I've come from this family system or this culture that murders people and rages at people and you know, has 5% of the world's population and puts 25% of its citizens in prison, like, you know, this country, more than any population in the world. Like, I forget what the number is, 2 or 3 or 10 times as many people as China does, and they talk about, you know, human rights and violations in China. We have 25% of our population, of the world's prison population here in America, and we only have 5% of its population. So what kind of insane? I mean, do we just have worse people than everybody else? I'd offer no, not in the least. But if you've been taught to live in rage and guilt and fear, you're supposed to fear God. Fear is the key to destroying intelligence of the mind the Creator gave us. And life is going to get pretty raunchy if people live in fear. So, you know, when we hear that fear about God, we're listening to Greek philosophy. We're not listening to Yeshua in the least. Does that fit? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I have a challenge here because I have a musical setting of it that I set many years ago.
Right.
And I had substituted the word loved, that you may be loved, for fear. Now, one of the ministers where we performed this complained and said, that's not what it says. You can't put that. But the opposite of fear in this case would be, I mean, the opposite of fear might be confidence or something, but the way it's meant here is, you're right, it's something like that you might be honored or respected. If you can think of a one-syllable word.
I would say that it would put where in our culture, I mean, you look at how God is put down. You know, the whole idea of a creator is abhorrent to millions and millions and millions of people, to the point where they say, you know, they call themselves atheists. And the bile and the, you know, the mewling and the puking on God in this culture is just unbelievable. And so there is no honor for, in many circles in this culture, for the idea of a creator. And so what I hear that passage saying is, once you allow yourself to truly connect to active present love, and you are conscious of doing that, and you begin to dissolve your own bewling and puking, you're going to come to the point where you're going to say, this is a pretty good dude. I want relationship with this kind of love. And everything changes. So that would be, to me, the practical application of that particular passage. And I think that that particular passage would be one that Yeshua would probably get right up on top of the steeple and say, this is all Greek baloney. It's not Aramaic.
So
it's not in harmony.
Are you saying that the word loved might be substituted there then?
Well, again, we'd end up going back to the discussion about, is love a noun or a verb?
Yeah.
And when you realize that it's a noun, you experience God as a powerful presence, a fact in your life that you experience love as a presence. You experience yourself as a presence, and then I would more be inclined to put the word honored in there, and then you will honor that presence.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the culture's idea where, you know, we all came in as active present love. We had it slapped out of us, and then we were told to go out and find somebody to love us or find somebody to love. And so the definition of the word was changed. When the definition of a word is changed, you lose the meaning of whatever that experience is. And so in this context, I would want to restore the real meaning of the word love, and that is, I will get to experience the Creator as this healing, active, vital force in my physiology that literally, because of the presence of the power of that love, begins the dissolution of my pain and my trauma. And when I do, I'm going to come to honor that greatly. And the passage that comes to mind with Yeshua in that regard is, and we've talked about this before, is the woman who has the 12-year issue of blood, and she knows that she can just touch the hem of his garment. And my take would be, it for her to, with a really horrendous disorder like she had, and it's especially horrendous in the Jewish culture where a woman who's on her period can't even go into the kitchen and make food for her family because she's quote-unquote unclean. And so what kind of work would she have to do to get to the point where she so honors the presence of love that this man Yeshua brings that she knows if she can just get into his field, and I would say that would be the meaning of touch the hem of his garment, if she has so much, she's so prepared, her field is so ready to be restructured, she knows if she can just get a taste of the vitalization that this man brings, that her physiology is going to shift in a second.
Michael,
and that's exactly what happened.
Oh, there you are. Lost you for a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So then let me just repeat that thought then. So what I was saying is that for her to be at the point, and if you remember when they want to give Yeshua the credit for this healing, he says, no, woman, it was your faith who made you whole. It was her readiness and her willingness to honor him as her support system, as such a powerful presence of love, that all she had to do was touch into the edge of that love, and she instantly had her whole energy field healed, and that 12-year disorder disappeared. Now, in that particular passage, we're told that there was a whole throng of people. I'm not sure exactly how many a throng is, but she's the only one that got healing. Nobody else was in that state of that this passage, I'd say, in Psalms is referring to, of, I'm ready to connect with that kind of presence, that kind of power, that kind of support. I've now prepared myself. I've come out of the world mind that says, I'm only in this because of God. It was God's will that this terrible thing happened and all the garbage that we've been fed by the world. But she was the only one out of this throng who was able to have enough trust at touching the presence of love that came through this man that her whole, I mean, she literally, you know, we've talked before about the people being in the sympathetic dominant state and moving to parasympathetic. I would say if we were standing there at that moment and had her hooked up to all the latest EEG machines and blood pressure and physiology and heart rate and all of that, I would guarantee that we would see her go from parasympathetic dominant, or pardon me, from sympathetic dominant to parasympathetic dominant in a fraction of a second, and that was the instant the flow of blood stopped. Because it reorganized her whole energy system. So am I willing to, and whatever word you wanted to use there for the word fear in that particular passage from Psalms, and I would say honor or openness to, willingness to receive support from, connect to, that's what's going to reorganize everything.
Even trust, maybe?
Trust. Mm-hmm.
Because I was flipping through different translations of that verse, and the Wycliffe Bible actually words it as, Lord, if you keep wickedness, who shall sustain or abide? Lord, if you keep a record of our wickedness, then who shall survive? Lord, who will not be condemned? For mercy is at thee, there is mercy with thee, and I stand in awe of thee.
Mm. Yeah, awe. And the mercy, you know, the fact is, you know, while we have all these conversations about God's judging and Jesus is going to come in the last day and judge him, what a pile of just pure bunk. You know, let's go back and listen to the man. What did he say when he said, what do you say about this woman who was caught in sin? He said, neither do I judge me. I came not to judge the world. But let's talk to the 32,000 sects of Christianity and see how many of them are saying, and yeah, in the last day he's going to come and judge the world. They don't have the slightest interest in his words or his teaching. They have an interest in maintaining the status quo that keeps them in their, you know, their little bailiwick, whatever's comfortable for them. And, you know, I mean, it's pretty crazy on its face.
Okay, that's very helpful.
The next line in, let me just reach for the book here. The next line in this particular passage, and I stopped at that with the thought of doing it tomorrow in this conversation with Richard. So we just shared, the translations appear sound, but are twisted just enough to cover up the wisdom that was available through the original words. I'm always amazed, this is my next comment to Richard, I'm always amazed by people who have studied Greek interpretations, often called translations, of Aramaic teachings, yet have no interest in the actual meanings of what they studied. No interest whatsoever. I mean, let's talk to 10,000 preachers who are talking about how in the last day he's going to come and judge the righteous and the unrighteous. And then let's ask that preacher. So now, here the man said in his life here, and this even comes through in the Greek, I come not to judge the world, but you've got a theology based on, in the end, you can keep people threatened by this guy who's going to come and judge them because you think they've quote-unquote sinned. I mean, the whole projection of that, the whole insanity of that's just outrageous and bizarre. I mean, there's so many things that are dogma and doctrine that just, you know, They just made no sense in the context of what the man said. You know, anyway, we could go on and on about that one, but so good passage.
I wonder.
Thank you.
I wonder if there is. I know you're working with translations of the Kabbalists, but that particular passage, you're talking about New Testament, so you haven't worked with that. I wonder what the Hebrew word
is
there.
We're talking
maybe
about Old Testament, you say?
Yeah, this is Old Testament.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I should have thought of that when I called and asked you, but it is Hebrew, and Hebrew and Aramaic are very similar. I wonder if I could talk to a rabbi about this or something. I need a word that would fit where this piece of music honored is too clumsy and has two syllables. I need one syllable. Of course, you know, not
worth. Jeannie, what was the word again that you came out of the Wycliffe?
Awe.
One word, simple, one syllable.
Yes.
There it is.
Tree of life is revered, but that's two.
Well, I can fiddle with it. It's no big deal. But I didn't even think. I thought, I'll ask Michael. He works with the Aramaic. Well, this isn't Aramaic originally. And
well,
it's Old Testament.
Let's
not...
back up a little bit. Let's back up a little bit. It was Aramaic originally. The Old Testament
Even the Psalms?
All of it. I can remember Jeannie when we were in Fort Lauderdale and we were introduced to a rabbi and he knew my orientation was to Yeshua, and he invited me to his house because one of his parishioners had really benefited from our work and wanted me to speak in his synagogue. Mm. And I sat down with him, and he offered me a cup of tea. This guy's about 6'7", and he said, now tell me about what you do. And I said, well, I'm working with the first century Aramaic meanings of words and in the New Testament. And he's like, he gets up, this guy's about 6'7", I'm sitting down, and he gives me, I've never had one of these from a 6'7", huge rabbi. He gets up from his side of the table and comes over and puts his arms around me. He says, I'm going to give you a schnuzzle. And he said, all of our wisdom keepers were Aramaic. If you can bring more
wonderful.
Of that wisdom into our congregation, please come and speak. And we did, and it was awesome. And the next week we spoke at the Holocaust Museum. And at the Holocaust Museum, with this whole room filled with his congregation and their friends, mostly Jewish, I brought up and talked about the Holocaust and the responsibility and what it took. And it was one of the most powerful, why is this happening to you again workshops I ever did. And the next day, I went into one of the deepest, most painful healing crises I've ever been
in. Oh, Michael. Oh, God. Amazing.
So, yes, the thought behind all of it was Aramaic. Hebrew is a daughter language to Aramaic. It is not the original language of the scriptures. And
okay.
Greek is certainly not even kolos. Although the Greek scholars who are, you know, I mean, they're getting their paycheck and they're, you know, they live in their little bailiwick and their ivory towers and all, they're not going to anytime soon, I suspect, go, oh, you mean Greek thought isn't the same as what Yeshua thought? I'm a Greek scholar. I'm going to have to go back to school and start over again and understand Aramaic thought. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah, it was probably. You're not going to find the Greek scholars saying that very soon, but. You know, the fact is, it was Aramaic, and it's just such a different thought structure that it's like,
okay.
It's the difference between, you know, we've talked about perception based in hostility or fear. It's the difference between having a language and a conversation that's all based in the belief in all the hostility and fear-based stuff. And having a conversation based in a love-based language and thought structure.
Well,
it's the difference between the two. And you can't speak Yeshua in Greek. You just can't do it. Does that fit, make sense for you?
It does, and my mind's exploding with five questions. But Okay.
Go for it.
Could I say? I'm going to have to sing a little bit and brace yourself. I'm not a singer, and this
go
will be
it.
More like croaking. But I'll give
We'd
you a little
We'd love to hear
break.
Your voice.
No, quiet. I want to get this across. If the Lord should mark iniquities, who shall stand? There is forgiveness with thee. Now here are the new words. I just thought of them. That we may know you as love.
Yeah.
That we may know you as love. How do you like it?
Perfect. Perfect. And I could hear it with an "and mercy" behind it. But that's it, yes.
Oh, say that again? That we may know
I could
you as
hear,
love and
I could
mercy?
Hear that same as love and mercy, yes.
Okay, I'll fool around with that.
Yeah. Sweet.
All right.
You know, that passage I refer to, say again?
Go ahead. I was just fooling with it. Go ahead.
Yeah, the passage that I refer to often that I've shared with the on the radio show many times, and I think I did it yesterday or the day before, a couple days ago, about the from the Course in Miracles. It says it would be interesting if you were asked to take a teaching function, yet discard all symbols of the world a while.
Yeah.
And then you were asked to go back to the world that darkness rules, not
mm-hmm.
because you believe darkness, but only to proclaim its unreality in terms that still have meaning in the world that darkness rules.
We
just did that passage. That's exactly what we just did. And that's the whole purpose of this piece of work.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Okay, well, you know, this is supposed to be sung in church in 2 weeks. I'm going to have to write
awesome.
To my minister and say, can I get away with this? And warn him and even have a talk with him. But how cool. Thank you. That was so helpful.
Awesome. Sweet. That's our job. That's what we're here to do.
I know. Oh, yeah. Michael, you said you had the worst healing crisis after that. There is a saying.
Oh, yeah.
Do we have to
it was
to
tough.
There, what?
It was tough.
There's a saying that
the healing crisis out of that experience was really difficult.
I bet. It must have been a doozy because you got close to the altar, and that's what I'm asking you about. I've heard it said that when you are getting close to the altar, meaning the highest and best truth, demons want to pull you away from there as fast as they can. So I don't know whether you had that experience of having stirred up the bad guys and they came to pester you out of your revelation or what?
Well, remember that when you hit a new level of vitality,
yeah,
it loosens the traumatic energies that have been suppressed by the lowered level of vitality.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. the example you've heard me use is we've got a vitality meter. It goes from 1 to 10. I'm at level 5 vitality. My toxicity is a level 10. I can want to deal with that level 10 toxicity till the cows come home, but there's a built-in suppress mechanism in the system that says, excuse me, if you're in level 5 vitality and we start letting loose of level 10 toxicity, it will kill you. You can't do that.
Yes.
We're not going to allow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not until I get to a level 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 that level 10 toxicity can break loose. And what's really clear to me is the opening that happened, the energetic opening that happened in that presentation, in that synagogue, and then at the Holocaust Museum was so
mm-hmm.
profoundly powerful. It just opened a whole new level on a physiological basis in my personal healing process. The insight, the opening, the energy that moved in that was just awesome. And, you know, I can remember I was kind of shaking in my boots a little bit presenting there because I'm, you know, I mean, I'm in the Holocaust Museum and I teach responsibility for what we've created. Michael, are you sure you want to bring that up in this setting? And when I got up to speak, I wasn't sure I was going to bring it up in that setting. And it was just like as natural as apple pie. And everybody in the audience went, yes. Oh, my God, I never thought of that. Job taught me that which I feared most has come upon me. When I speak about never again, I just focused on again. And as a creator, I'm going to create more of the again. So am I willing to take responsibility and move through that? And I mean, take responsibility for such a thing as the Holocaust, my part in it, and then process through and heal that part? Because that part, in that passage you just gave us from Psalms, they're the iniquities that they're talking about. And what they're saying, in essence, to decode that further, I could say, so here I am, Creator. I have all this iniquity in me. I have this hate and this fear and this rage and this hatred and this vengeance. And I'm now realizing that if you keep a record of it, it's just reinforced, and who can ever get free of it? But, oh, thank God, you're the presence of love that empowers the healing of this now that I'm willing to face it and move through it.
And well,
the healing process is not
going to
be Dr. Feelgood. Say again?
That's a tremendous challenge to the Jews, too, because it's always a temptation to see oneself as the victim because terrible
every
things
one
have
of
happened.
Them. Every one of them in the audience went, yes, I got it. That which I feared most. And every one of them did worksheets. There was another time when I was in Fort Lauderdale speaking at the Jewish Women's Service Club. There were about 100 women in the audience. And it was right at the time when they weren't letting Jews out of Russia. And the speaker before me is up there railing against never again, and, you know, we need to fight, and and on we went. And I'm getting up afterwards to deliver a message of responsibility. And we did a worksheet around the Jews not being let out of Russia. 100 women in the room did a worksheet. Every one of them did it and canceled the goal. And it was about, I don't even remember exactly now because this is years ago, but it was a couple of months later. And the whole policy in Russia was changed, and they started to let the Jews out of Russia. And when I heard that, it was like I got the really clear hit. What changed the energy dynamic on planet Earth so that that could change with Russian officialdom was the women, the work those 100 women did in Fort Lauderdale in that room
that
night.
That's giving me chills. That is so
gorgeous. Yeah, it gave me chills, too. What it's all about. And if necessary, let's continue this communication tomorrow, but the show is just about over. Man, this is the fastest hour we've done in a while. And so I'm going to just say to everybody, thank you for your questions very much, Susan, as usual. And everybody, have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.